Big Adventures with Brian Durker is supported by Cloud Chaser Creative and Humphrey Summit Ski. Humphrey Summit Ski has been supplying Flagstaff and the surrounding area with quality ski and snowboard equipment for the last 40 years. Humphrey Summit Ski offers quality service, repairs, boot fitting, and more, all from the friendliest staff in Arizona, on the corner of Beaver and Elm, and in Grand Canyon Spirits on Humphrey Street in Flagstaff.
Hi everyone, welcome to Big Adventures. With me, I'm Brian Durker. I'm a boatman in Grand Canyon and have been for the last 50 years. And along the way, I have met the most remarkable personalities and storytellers that I've met anywhere else on the planet. So our intention here is to introduce you to these personalities and hear their stories. And we will learn about the place, the private sector, the commercial sector of boating in Grand Canyon, as well as a tremendous amount of science and administrative interests that might come along the way as far as this great national treasure. So welcome and settle in. I'm excited to introduce this next guest I have to you. It's Larry Stevens, and he and I go way back. We're old friends from the late 70s when we were young boatmen working down in Grand Canyon, rowing boats for small companies. Larry was with Wilderness World. I was with Grand Canyon Youth, and we've been friends ever since. But since then, Larry's done a remarkable career that you're going to get in on here as far as his scientific observations and studies in Grand Canyon. And he's a treasure trove of stories and real valuable information as far as what makes the Grand Canyon tick. So I want to introduce you to Larry Stevens here. I guess my first question for you is, where were you born? Takes it right back to the beginning.
That's a challenging question, Brian. But thank you for asking. My lineage extends back more than 4 billion years.
You are a biologist.
By some freakish accident, I was born in the City of Magic.
Okay.
A lot of people don't know that reference about Cleveland, but refers to Randy Newman song about the burning Cuyahoga River.
And so how long were you in Cleveland?
As short a time as I possibly could manage. And as soon as I got to the point where I could get out, I did.
And was that after high school?
Yeah, after high school. I came out to go to college at Prescott College. Met Brad Dimmick and all of our friends that went to Prescott College.
Right. Great. A classic group you were.
Yeah.
That age and time.
I was very fortunate to meet a lot of those people.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Anyway, so after finishing Prescott, went to work for the National Park Service as a test tube washer, a technician up in the lab on the South Rim there. And gradually moved from that into doing what I actually did know how to do, which is watch birds and understand what bugs are around. And after about a year or so, I got approached by a guy by the name of Steve Carruthers. And Steve needed somebody to work on the insects of Grand Canyon. And that's something I had a fair amount of expertise in knowing how to do. And Steve, at his interview with me, asked me if I wanted to do science Larry, do you want to do science or do you want to eat?
Which is a great question.
Not for a scientist. It doesn't matter to a scientist. I wanted to do science.
And you're not going to eat even if you are a scientist because of the way they pay scientists.
That's right? True. I ended up that 2 years of work with $4.10 to my name, and I walked around Flagstaff to try to find somebody who'd be willing to hire somebody who knew a little bit about rowing and a little bit more about the bugs of Grand Canyon. And unbeknownst to me, Vladimir Kovalik had just fired all of his crew, and I was hired on as scab labor for Wilderness World.
I remember those times, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's how I got started at the river. From then did master's and PhD work at U of A and NAU here. And all this time I've been a research associate at the museum. And that's a position that I now hold as a curator of biology.
Fantastic. And was Steve interested in Grand Canyon bugs and stuff when you first hooked it up with Steve? Was he looking at Grand Canyon, or was he looking at a bigger, broader picture?
He was more interested in that project on the ecological inventory of Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
He hadn't really thought about bugs very much, except as bird food at that point. And I think what really sealed our relationship was we opened up a piece of mesquite down there. It was a great big fat beetle grub in the wood, a couple of them. And so I just popped one in my mouth and gave one to Steve and watched him turn several shades of purple, because he's not a guy that would lightly ignores a dare.
Yeah, no, you had to do it. You had to do it. Now, are you presently employed with the museum? Is that your primary income source?
So for the last, since 2006, I've been the honorary curator of biology at the Museum of Northern Arizona here in Flagstaff. So I develop projects, proposals, bring money to the museum to support my position there.
Yeah. And how are things at the museum these days?
Well, we just got a new director, so we're seeing what new directions she'll put forth. But the museum is holding its own. It's been breaking even, and there are about 50 employees out there now, so it's a pretty big operation.
It's up a little bit. Then wasn't there a little while there that it was pretty skeletal?
Yeah, it's had some challenges in the past, and the biology department was kind of in mothballs after Steve left until I took over.
Uh huh.
So.
And, you know, I was trying to think of the first time you and I met. It goes way back there. And I think it was during the time when Steve had those boats.
Snout rigs
for the museum.
Yeah.
They were those split snouts.
Yeah, yeah.
And are you still doing anything with Steve? Does he ever bring you in for contract work? Or
no, I don't work for him, but I've brought him on as a research associate at the museum, and he is beginning to do more research at the museum again. So his son Tanner is pursuing a master's degree at NAU, and Tanner and his dad are both doing quite a few river trips.
Oh, and they're really excited right now. They're really looking at the increasing goose population.
Have you
talked to them about that?
I have, yeah, yeah.
One of the things I've really been looking forward to talking to you about, and I know you've had tremendous interest, and it's such a relevant issue, is our groundwater. And can you tell us about the work that you've been doing with the springs and the little ecosystems involved? Can you share that with us?
So I serve on the Federal Advisory Committee overseeing the operation of Glen Canyon Dam. And that's a huge environmental undertaking. It's 27 different stakeholders, tribes, representatives of the states, water and power buffaloes right and left, all the federal agencies. What I know from that process is that when you're dealing with water resources in the Southwest, arguably our most critical resource, any kind of policy movement takes a lot of time. So many voices, everybody's got a concern about it. What occurred to me after a few years of doing that and have been studying springs for a long time is that springs are a different story. You've got just a couple stakeholders. If you want to do something, even something fairly dramatic at a spring, it doesn't take that much effort. It doesn't take that much kind of negotiation to get something done. And springs are places that are just incredible hotspots for biodiversity, for cultural resources, for economics, for everything. So there's good reason to take better care of them, and nobody's doing it. So I thought that might be an interesting kind of avenue to pursue. So Jerry Ledbetter and I started the Spring Stewardship Institute with a couple of colleagues over at NAU and other universities. And that kind of kicked that off officially in 2013. And over the last, 7 years now, we've built that up into an international effort that is Jerry works on database design and production. So we've got an online database that anybody studying Springs can store their data in. Yeah, it's a pretty fantastic information tool, information management system that we've got for people. We do workshops all over the place. I'll do probably 10 of them this year before the dust settles, in Mexico, in Canada, in the United States. It's a global undertaking. I've done some work in Europe. And the concept here is a bit different of a conservation strategy than save the whales or save the Pacific Ocean or something. It's more taking care of small points in the landscape that kind of matter a lot, that actually do matter a lot. The springs play, not only do they have their own kind of fauna, but they're also very important little patches in the landscape because everything in the landscape might be coming in to use the spring.
Yeah, absolutely. And now to explain a little further as far as how you look at a spring, when you walk up on a spring, what are some of the main elements in that spring that you look at? Obviously, probably flow is a major one. Water quality would be one. But can you explain that a little bit as to how you approach a spring?
Yeah. So I've had to train myself to not assume anything about what I'm getting into when I come up on a spring. These are places that often the eyes of science have never laid foot on. We come across a spring, say visiting a spring that's been named. Okay, so somebody's, you know, spent some time thinking about this place, maybe doing things at it. Maybe it's a site that's been excavated and there's buried piping that you can't even tell. It was done 100 years ago. You have no idea.
Interesting.
So you understand that when you step up into a spring system, there's going to be history. And the history may or may not be known, probably is not going to be known. Similarly, there'll be an evolutionary history for the site. The spring has been, you know, playing a role in the landscape sometimes for millions of years. In the case of a place like Montezuma Well, it's millions of years of time that spring has been there and functioning in ways we can't even imagine. 15,000 years ago, elephants could have been wallowing in it. Every big spring in the U.S. has been used by humans for 12 to 15,000 years. So there's a human imprint on these things as well. You can't just pretend like you're going to, say, develop a restoration plan for a spring to bring it back to its pristine condition, because they've always had human impacts on them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So it's a very, very much a kind of human in the landscape kind of approach that we adopt for these. The data we collect are, you're right, flow and water chemistry, but also all the biota that we can kind of detect within our brief site visit. That might be an hour and a half or 2 hours, but typically we can get 95% of the plants at the site figured out. Many of the aquatic invertebrates, if there are rare invertebrates, we can detect them typically in that first visit. And that helps set the stage for understanding where we should go back in the landscape, what sites need more attention, and how to get them into the eyes of the managers in an appropriate way.
Well, I have to admit, every time, and I spend a fair amount of time in Grand Canyon, I think about you when I just look at springs, and I think about springs a lot more as a result of being interested in your work. And like, this was a fantastic winter we had last winter. And after a couple years of really worrying about places like Vasey's Paradise or Dutton Springs, thought about you, what joy it would bring you to see these things pumping the way they did in the spring this year.
Yeah.
And that brings me to my next question, Grand Canyon specific. I know some dye work has been done by the Park Service from the north side there. Do you have any interesting results from what they did up there? Or are you familiar with that dye experiment?
Yeah, I'm somewhat familiar with it. It was coordinated by Ben Tobin, who's a karst and cave geologist who worked for the park for 3 years or so, and also with Abe Springer, who's supplied students to do the work. What they did was they took these inert, non-toxic dyes and put them into sinkholes on the north rim, and then set up a very elaborate monitoring system I think they looked at about 40 springs, several dozen springs, to see when the dye passed through all that limestone landscape and out into the springs. And for the dye results, they've come back so far. It's taken a couple of years for the groundwater to actually flow from where they put it in up on the North Rim at almost 9,000 feet to come out. One of the big surprises out of that work is that the dye has actually come out in two different places that are almost 50 miles apart.
Right. I understood something like that.
So these flow paths are, the flow paths are not really, really understandable. It's the landscape is deeply fractured. The water's following the fractures and it goes all over the place.
So you're talking like Vasey's Paradise and Thunder River.
Thunder River. Yeah.
Wow.
So really remarkable.
How interesting
flow path.
Is
yeah.
that?
And very fast, but very fast. That's really fast for groundwater to move. We've got springs on the south side where the flow path is between more than 3,000 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's really a whole different story.
Yeah, and we have not gotten a good age estimate on the water coming out of Blue Springs. That could be 10,000, 15,000 years. That's coming off the peaks, flowing through all that intervening terrain.
Oh, that's right. That would be coming off that side of the peaks.
Yeah. And so there's probably some of it coming off the north side of the LCR as well. But yeah.
And if that's old water coming out at a certain rate, it probably doesn't have the fluctuation element that the faster water has.
Right.
Am I right?
So these deep water aquifers tend to be pretty decoupled from climate. They can flow as long as the aquifer is not being tapped and the aquifer is functioning. They can flow centuries later than some major climate change.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's interesting. Where we get a much more direct response in the springs to the north.
Yeah.
And it's that the karst caves and the whole matrix of the limestone aquifer is just a lot. Now, would you imagine that there's a reservoir in there and the result of seasonal snowfall and snowpack, is that just affecting the top of a holding tank and pushing it out, or is it really direct? And do you have any ideas as to what kind of a aquifer it is? Is it a fairly passive, or is there some old water in there?
Yeah, good question. Every spring has a signature of both local recharge and longer distance, longer time frame recharge. And sorting those fractions out is what makes dating water so difficult. We thought dating was difficult in high school. Hydrologic dating is just a friggin' nightmare.
Well, hopefully it isn't the disaster that some of that high school dating was.
Anyway, so the aquifers of the North Rim are fed by snowpack, and we see a very quick response to snowmelt in places like Thunder River in the springtime. But that's not actually the water that is passing through. It's the pressure function. Yeah. So imagine a spring. Imagine a bucket with half full of water with a hole in the side of the bucket. If the water in the bucket goes above the hole, the spring will flow. And the more water you put into the bucket, the more the water will jet out of that. And as the water descends and gets to the point of that, it'll stop flowing and it drops below. You can still have a lot of water in the bucket, but the spring will stop flowing.
Brilliant. I've always suspected that. I've never been able to get my hands around the age of the water. And then that comes to my next question, which is how those dyes get there as quickly as they do, like within a year or two. Even if you do have that bucket, it seems like it would take a lot longer for the flow-through rate.
So I think a couple of things have come out recently that are good to think about. Grand Canyon is the second largest karstic park in the country, the first being Everglades. And we didn't really see Grand Canyon that way until Ben Tobin and Abe Springer kind of figured that story out. It's almost all about karst. And karstic systems, which are limestones that have been kind of weathered and worked by water, are really flashy. So they do respond very quickly to increases in melted snow. This kinematic function of water passing because of pressure is happening there, and the water is not retained all that long necessarily in these karstic systems. Other systems like Coconino sandstone, definitely thousands of years, no problem at all. Where you encounter water that is highly mineralized and kind of warmish, either warm or you know, even hot sometimes, those tend to be long flow path springs.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. The exception would be geothermal, which we don't have in Grand Canyon, but geothermal can be a faster flow path. But where you have warm, highly mineralized water, like at Blue Springs, Havasu Springs, Pumpkin Spring is classic. That water is easily 10,000 years. It's who knows how old that stuff is. It may be coming out of the schist. It's got such a mineralogical connection to it. It's got archaea in it, which is a bacteria type that is formerly thought only to live on the floor of the ocean in seafloor vents. But it's coming out at places like
right?
Coming out at Pumpkin Spring.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a spring that's damaged, what kind of damage are you seeing, or how do you help a spring?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So we put together a restoration handbook for Arizona springs. Springs are generally viewed as being state resources, so each state probably has slightly different approaches to how they manage them. But when we visit a spring, we look for signs of human impacts, look for things that are correctable. Maybe there's leaky pipes or down fences or some old structure that's not really needed there anymore. So some of the recommendations that we make to the managers are pretty straightforward. It's a hill slope spring, and the people are taking water and kind of manipulating the source up on a hill slope. You got to put a trail in. Otherwise, the hill slope will just erode as people kind of walk willy-nilly up the slope. What we can do most easily at springs is to repair the geomorphology. And so that's usually the approach. What is it going to take to repair the geomorphology? Sometimes that can be kind of a big deal. If it's a spring, like we did a restoration project out at Pacoon Ranch up in northwestern Arizona, big springs complex that John Wesley Powell wrote a essay from in 1874.
Oh, wow.
The landowners had used it as a cattle operation and then as an ostrich ranch. And they took all 10 sources. They took a bulldozer in and excavated the sources to create open water. And so our challenge there was we didn't know what was going on hydrologically. It had been so altered. So we went in and filled in all the ponds and just let the water choose its course and then used that to help guide where we put channels and where we needed to protect runs of streams. We rewatered a stream that had been dewatered for 100 years. That's now the longest stream on the Grand Canyon Parashant National Monument.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. We also had to take out an alligator that the previous landowner had let go in the nicest swimming hole in all of northern Arizona. Clem was 9 feet long when we finally caught him, and he's now living happily in the – well, happily, I don't know. He's still meaner than a snake, but he lives down in the Phoenix Herpetological Gardens.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Now, is this private property that you're talking about?
Private ranch land that was then sold to the BLM after the landowner decided to unload it.
We have some beautiful springs on a piece of property down in Sedona. Have you been to our place down there?
I've been to your place, but not. It was in winter, and we didn't walk around very much.
Yeah, well, we'll have to take a drive down there sometime. It would really be fun to for you to look at the whole system down there.
Yeah.
To move on a little bit more, what else are you guys doing over at Northern Arizona or at the museum? What other projects have you guys got going right now?
We have about 18 projects going right now. Each of them has its own kind of set of objectives, but they mostly focus on springs or on biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And so part of the charge with the museum is to assemble all the information on all the biodiversity of the Colorado Plateau, which is something on the order of 25,000 species at least of macro life that we think we have. 20,000 species of insects, 500 vertebrates, and a couple thousand plant species.
Wow.
So pulling all that information together, making it available to people is what we're trying to do. Putting together right now a huge compendium of the invertebrate life of the whole Colorado Plateau.
Uh-huh. And are you using, as far as man labor, a lot of student labor for your data collection?
It's a lot of students. How do you go about that? Yeah. So we bring in students. We bring in professors. The people that can identify a lot of these groups are very few. Taxonomy is a dying art. And so finding the person that works on this or that genus of a beetle that we detect is quite challenging. Sometimes that individual is not in the U.S. We have to send the specimens overseas to have it identified.
And when you take these specimens, do you have a facility at the museum that?
Yeah, I've compiled a collection of about 500,000 specimens.
Oh, is that right?
And with Jerry Ledbetter's help, getting that body of information database, trying to understand what the elevation and habitat needs are of all these different species as a way to kind of foresee what climate change threats will do to our landscape.
What is that spring in Nevada that has the pupfish? Have you been to that spring?
Many springs have pupfish. Ash Meadows, the Ash Meadows pupfish lives at a half a dozen springs in that landscape, for example. That's one of about 20 different pupfish species are all spring specialists. So we're working on that project, working kind of tangentially with that project, but we've got a really large project going on in which we're coordinating discussion between the states of Nevada and Utah about preserving critters called spring snails, which are little tiny aquatic snails, 100 species living at probably 5,000 to 10,000 springs. It's the biggest springs conservation project ever undertaken in the world. So coordinating that.
Wow, that sounds big.
Pretty fun.
I guess one other question, since we're on springs, would be the Kanab amber snail. Do you know what's its latest status?
Yeah, the snail formerly known as the Kanab amber snail has been driven to taxonomic extinction because it has been re-described as a different taxon, a different subspecies of the Niobrara snail.
Oh, interesting.
So now it's called the Niobrara snail, and it no longer exists, at least in the eyes of the scientific community. The Fish and Wildlife Service still lists it as an endangered species, even though it doesn't exist anymore.
Who was the game and fish fella that worked on the snails?
Jeff Sorensen.
Jeff Sorensen. I ran into Jeff at Little Colorado, of all places, a month or two ago.
Yeah.
And he said that they can't find a snail at Vasey's.
He's in charge of protecting them. It's his job as a state employee to do so, and we hope he can, you know, get it together to relocate
them.
Well,
you know, it's interesting to me because I worked with him for some of those transplants, like to the Deer Creek
Upper Elves,
and evidently Upper Elves still has a few of them. I think he mentioned that.
Was originally, you know, he started that as an insurance program for the Vasey's Paradise population. And if it's time to call in the insurance resources there, it might be time. But, you know, I'm not allowed to look for them at Vasey's Paradise anymore. That takes a special permit.
Even though we
discovered them there, but
sense there's a great past relationship that you've gotten to share with Jeff and some of those other game and fish.
We've had a long association, and look forward to hearing more about what he's not finding there.
Now, another spring that's always interesting to me is just like if you're headed to Salt Lake and you've just driven through Kanab, Utah. And there are those pools. Is that where there are similar snails? What's the story on those?
The original kind of distribution of Kanab amber snails was they were collected first in, I think, 1911 by a fellow by the name of Ferris at some place that he called the Greens on Kanab Creek. It took about 10 years for Vicky Moretzky and me to figure out where the Greens actually were. And they're actually up near the best friends. They're actually on the best friend's property, that animal care place.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
However, another population of what was called Kanab amber snail was discovered at Three Lakes, those ponds along Highway 89 there. And so we had permission to go in there from the landowner to look at that population and collected some snails there and identify that. So we had, at the time, we had just three populations, Three Lakes, They were at the Greens still when we finally relocated that, and at Vasey's Paradise. Then found another population of something that turned out to be, again, the Niobrara snail upstream from Lee's Ferry at minus 9 mile, and another population at Indian Gardens. So in Arizona, just three populations for that species of snail, one of which was called Kanab amber snail. And since that taxonomic revision of the species, still it's quite relevant. We've only got three populations of that genus of snails in Arizona.
And as I recall, didn't you have a refuge or Jeff or the people working with the Kanab amber snail? Didn't they have at the base of the dam a population that was there for refuge or for...
Yeah, these are in the days before 9/11, of course, and when our relations with the Bureau of Reclamation were quite congenial. They still are pretty congenial, but permission to raise an endangered species on the dam was something that was... Everybody took... That kind of perked up everybody's eyes.
Great joy.
Yeah.
Great joy.
Yeah. And that... That project worked really well. We've raised the snail on non-native watercress on the face of the dam. And we actually had the largest Kanab amber snail that's ever crawled the earth come out of that set of experiments. The snail was it was more than an inch long. It was just like Moby Dick of
the monster amber snail. And just for people to visualize what we're talking about, at the base of the dam is a, of course, the dam leaks a certain amount of water. And there's a nice little stream that runs right next to a perfectly mowed lawn at the very base of the dam. And then that lawn is behind the power houses and stuff for the generators. And it's a very odd place. And I was lucky enough to, go there a couple times when he was doing his work. So it's kind of interesting. Yeah. And obviously there's something in the water that makes snails large and strong, huh?
Well, that site actually tended, when we did the water chemistry and the solar radiation budget, it's almost it's very, very similar to Vasey's Paradise. That's why we chose it.
Yeah.
And so, we were able to raise snails in that sluice way. And everything worked really well for 2 years until we had a very hard thunderstorm right on the dam. And what we didn't know is that the dam, the surface of the dam flakes off in these very high, kind of strong thunderstorms. And so we had all kinds of concrete plummet down and smash our tanks and do all kinds of damage there.
Oh, interesting.
So that kind of closed the experiment down.
Mean old dam, it never quits, does it? Well, it's got a little something for everybody.
It was kind of an interesting set of phone calls going there, back and forth between the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau and us. I was the Park Service ecologist, Grand Canyon ecologist at that time.
So you were right in there.
Yeah. Pretty fun. Pretty fun.
I've got a couple questions I want to ask just on a more general level. One of them, and it's probably an obvious answer you give me on this one, but what has the overall effect of the outdoors had on your life? I mean, the outdoors, obviously, when you were born, might have been harder to attain as far as the setting that we've grown accustomed to out here in the West, but even at a young age, was the outdoors a high impact element in your life?
I have some really wonderful childhood memories. Most of my family comes from northern New Hampshire. We got 12 generations, 13, 14 generations up there now. We fought for the independence of Vermont after the Revolutionary War.
My God, I would hope so.
Yeah, too bad we lost these days, especially. But so my earliest kind of outdoor memories that were just standing way out were getting to hike up into the mountains of northern New Hampshire and go fishing with my grandfather and traipsing around in the woods there. And I remember one time he kind of gill hooked a little trout. He called me Stevie. Stevie, that trout's it's injured down there. We got to go get it. Take off your clothes, dive down in that water, and get it. And I could swim, so I took off my clothes, and the water was just friggin' ice water. It's no wonder he didn't want to go down there. But I came back up with a fish and put it in the creel, and off we went. So,
and that's it. The start of your long and interesting life.
Yeah. Well, many other adventures too in those early days, but did a lot of canoeing in the boundary waters. And the more time I could get, I tried to get out of Cleveland as much as I possibly could, and had some pretty great adventures doing that.
Yeah, I've heard the boundary waters are just phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah. Went driving down to Florida to collect water moccasins, and you know, having all the fun that kids can have if they're interested in biology.
That brings me to my next question, which is, in your perspective, how can the outdoors and the environment in general frame our society in a better way? Or how do we get to society and use some of the things that we get out of the environment and the outdoors? How do we get to society with that?
You know, talking about it doesn't work. That's what I know. You can get people excited about topics and environmental themes and whatnot by talking about it, but unless you're out there doing it, it's just not, it doesn't come across to people as the life-changing experience that you and I have both seen on river trips many, many, many times. So the real task is how to get people out of doors, how to get kids out of doors, especially teenagers. Because they're so locked into the electronics now, it's really a losing battle as these devices take over consciousness, human consciousness. So we can be the figures that we are to society as however the society gets to see us. You in the movies, me through written, you know, scientific papers that nobody reads, or occasional books that get a little more attention. But really, it's about, if you just coax people away from the electronics and out into the wildlands, going for a walk, you know, all it takes is three steps and you start to get engaged in, what's this fly? What's this? Oh, there's a snake over there. What's this pine tree doing here? What's that bird calling? Just shifting that attention a little bit. And you've seen it. I'm sure you've seen it on many folks that you've been with. You shift the people's attention away from their kind of box that they live in, and give them a little bit of exposure to something else, and they start to see differently, and then it takes off. But that's that critical step of you know, stepping outdoors.
You know, that I like that. I have seen some. Let's talk about the cities, or let's talk about Cleveland, or let's talk about some of these big cityscapes. I've seen some brilliant efforts to bring nature into some of these cityscapes, and I'm not sure what city it was. I was watching where they took an old railroad, raised railroad, and vegetated the thing and made basically a long string of a park through the city. In those efforts, those have to be super valuable. The more that they can bring nature into the interior of the city. Have you been involved with any projects like that?
Yeah, although the projects I've been involved in have been more about exploring what the biodiversity of cities actually is. So there's quite a bit of effort going into, say, looking at pollinators in cities. As you move away from the city, the pollinator assemblage expands greatly. But even in the middle of New York City, there'll be native bees and native flies that are coming into flowers.
And probably moths.
And some moths, yep, sure. Although the lights, there's a whole kind of story of light pollution just completely eliminating species that are attracted to light. But so the pollinators are something people can see during the day if they pay a little bit of attention. They're often, if you can get a good close look at them, they're just fabulous, fabulous critters. So that's an element of it. Birdwalk, if there is a park in the city, being able to bring people out on a bird walk on a Sunday morning or something is often a real eye-opener.
Yeah, that's huge.
Because, and during migration, all kinds of birds are coming through cities.
Now, with that, whole environmental hit that we're taking as administrations change, and we're seeing a lot of reduction in these national lands that were set aside by previous administrations. And a lot of the hits that we're taking with this existing situation we're in, is there hope?
The beauty to me is that the natural world doesn't care a lick about us. In our self-inflated sense of importance, nature doesn't care a lick. If we exceed our boundaries, you know, we're to blame, and we will pay for it. Nature will it simply accommodates life, and the kind of story of how evolution takes place is often just kind of frightful conditions that are, you know, highly detrimental to a lot of individual species and individual organisms. These things are it's the way that's the way that natural selection takes place. We're subject to that. We're still evolving in ways that we can't even really begin to understand, and our social behaviors are having an effect on our genes. The process is going on, and nature doesn't care. Evolution doesn't have an endpoint. I've been studying a bit up on the environments that were taking place during the major extinction events and the Permo-Triassic extinction event, you know, the difference between the Kaibab and the overlying Moenkopi there. That time period was 5 million years of acid rain across the entire Earth.
Is that right?
That anything survived that 5 million years. The ocean temperatures were 100 degrees Fahrenheit. You know, nature is incredibly harsh, that life somehow was able to survive that. And when you see a dragonfly, their lineage extended across it. When you see us, the tetrapods, right? We're tetrapods. Two ghost lineages survived this early extinction event that took place in the Devonian. We don't have any fossil record of our real ancestors. We're orphaned from the paleontological record that way. And somehow, some fossorial living in the earth critter, set of critters, was able to survive that kind of
remarkable,
incredible, just astounding.
It like even like you look at a good forest fire, and it's always amazing to me how quickly nature goes to the repair.
Yeah,
and that does that alone. Nature, quite possibly, is the only hope we have. Right?
It's a sad hope to pin our dreams on, because we could do much better.
Well, and that would segue into an interesting perspective you might have on this whole global warming element and the extinction that we're in. What are we in, the fifth great extinction?
Sixth, yeah.
I hate to say what can be done by the humans, but what's your impression of the actual human impact in regards to global warming? Is it for real that it's been tremendously accelerated since the industrial?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that at all. Anybody in any of the sciences, anybody that's really looking at the facts is completely convinced that humans have had an inexorable effect on climate, and it's already too late.
Yeah.
We've already stepped beyond the bounds of predictability. And even if we try very, very hard right now and cut carbon emissions, it's already the changes that are going to go on will go on.
Yeah.
This has happened before. It's happened really dramatically about 55 million years ago. And really the Earth has been cooling for the last 65, 70 million years or so. And so, but these events are extinction events, and we'll see how life moves through.
But
the saving grace for me, again, is that natural history is inexhaustibly creative.
But wouldn't this be the first time that an organism on Earth has such an impact on this warming trend?
No.
Flatulating dinosaurs?
No, it was actually flatulating diatoms. The biggest one of the biggest extinction events, we don't have much of a record of it, happened about 2.2 billion years ago when the Earth's atmosphere turned over from bathroom gases to free oxygen. And so that completely altered the entire course of life. So it's, you know, we've had quite a few extinction events that have really reshaped the whole trajectory of evolution. And it will be unfortunate if that's our legacy, but it's happened because of life before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, fascinating conversation. I could sit here for hours with you. I know, we've kind of run out of time on this, But I would hope that I can invite you back, because a guy like you, one session on this chat line here that we've got going is definitely not enough. Thanks so much for taking the time and sitting in on this with us.
Brian, thank you so much. You know that you're one of my heroes, and we've been friends for since I can't remember when. So,
well, vice versa. I mean, we've always had a great friendship since we first met, and let's continue. Let's keep the ball rolling. But thanks again. We look forward to the next visit.
Completely my pleasure.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for sitting in on that. Wasn't that fantastic? I'm going to start looking for amber snails in other places, but I really want to thank Larry for sitting in and sharing just an inkling of what he's all about, and we'll look forward to having him as a guest again. This is Brian Durker of Big Adventures, and stay right side up.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Buchner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.